Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money and helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas Groß, and today I'm joined again by our guest host Jonathan Noll from Etonic. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Jonas. Great to be back for another episode of our digital money interview series.
Yes, and today we are joined by once more a very exciting guest. Actually, I've been waiting for this episode for quite a while. It's Joey Garcia. He's Executive Director and Chief Strategy, Policy and Regulatory Affairs Officer at Xapo Bank. I think a bank that is very deep and I would say also like leading a lot of domains around digital money, digital assets, but I'm sure we'll talk about this later. Joey is, I think, considered one of the pioneers of digital currency and regulation around blockchain technology with work spanning Xapo, as I mentioned, also Gibraltar's digital asset ecosystem, Libra Diem, we'll hear about that as well, and also as a specialist work with the United Nations Office on global blockchain and cryptocurrency standards. So, Jonathan, how did you actually get to know Joey?
Yeah, I had the good fortune of meeting Joey very, very early days of the Libra Association, very early days. Xapo was a founding member of the Libra Association, and Joey represented Xapo from a sort of a governance perspective. And I am, as you mentioned, just kind of double-clicking on what you just said. I'm super excited to have Joey on the show. He's one of the, I would consider sort of a legal scholar, right? So he'll talk a little bit more about his background, but he's got a legal training. He writes a lot about this. And in addition, he was one of the early ones, did crypto regulation out of Gibraltar well before even FATF came around with a lot of their guidance as a specialist consultant, as you mentioned, for the UN. So he worked very closely in that role with a lot of the Asian regulators. We were even able to come in and do some workshops with Joey at the time, which was very exciting. And he's also done a lot of work in the US and the UK. So somebody that has really this incredibly well-rounded regulatory legal perspective of something, I'm super excited about. So it's a great chance for us to talk a little bit about Libra, maybe within the context of all these really interesting stablecoin moments happening right now, like OpenUSD, et cetera. Talk about what Xapo Bank is doing in the space, which I think is very exciting and also very unique. And then really talk about the global regulatory landscape from, as you said, you know, it's one of the leading thinkers in DLT regulation. So with that, for a man who needs no introduction, that was a pretty long introduction, but Joey, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, guys. No, really exciting. I'm a bit bizarre listening to people talk about me, but no, it's very exciting to be here and really looking forward to it. It'll be good chat, I'm sure.
Great. Well, hey, let's jump right into it. Just as a you know, obviously we've known each other for years, but talk us through, like, for our listeners who don't know your story as well as I do, how did you find your way, just briefly, into digital money, stablecoins, regulation? How did you land at Xapo Bank? Tell us about your origin story.
I think like in this world of, like, let's just call it innovation and development, new technology, new systems, new assets, it's a very exciting new development. Everyone talks about innovation at that end, but you need sort of innovation across the spectrum. So let's call it legal innovation, reg innovation, different ways of thinking and approaching risk, etc. I mean, that's also a pretty fundamental pillar to creating a secure ecosystem and environment. So the answer to your question is, back in whenever it was, 2014, I met this guy called Wences Casares, who anyone in the Bitcoin space will definitely know. And we had a long series of meetings and discussions, and I heard this sort of wonderful background story around the development of BTC as a concept and what it was and what it meant and what it was built to do. But the biggest gap back then, this is 2014, was sort of, you know, legal reg frameworks didn't exist. It was, as you mentioned before, Jonathan, 5 years before the FATF came out with their original June 19 recommendations, etc. And that was the kind of pillar of discussion. Like, where can we start to have a conversation around developing a framework that creates a secure environment, not regulating the technology, regulating the access points to that technology, to create a sort of consumer-facing, you know, system that allows people to enjoy and integrate and gain exposure to this evolving world in a secure environment. And that's why you mentioned as well, guys, approaching Gibraltar, you know, jurisdictions move slowly. The US can take a long time. The EU can take a long time as well. I mean, MiCA, was what, 5-6 years in development. Crowdfunding standards took like 8 years to come around. It's a slow moving piece. Small jurisdictions move, they have greater appetite, they have greater willingness, and they need to take those routes. So, you know, the City of London or New York, you know, if there's something that isn't going quite right, it's not really a big issue. Small jurisdictions don't have that, and they need the adaptability focus on development. So it was seen as a new opportunity. But back then, you know, I approached the government and said, you know, we should create some sort of initiative and conduct an assessment. They said, create a working group. But even back then, 2014, if you use the word Bitcoin and you talked about regulation, I mean, there were some working groups that I sat down where I literally had, instead of like regulatory sort of policy teams, there were like police officers that were sent to the initial meetings or sort of enforcement unit. So it was all sort of a really bizarre conversation. And back then, again, you know, same, go to the City of London, go to New York, talk about BTC as a concept, ask for a meeting with a law firm, and they thought you were like trying to facilitate money laundering or do something awful. So it was a completely, completely different world. But I was really kind of inspired by the whole challenge. I did buy into the future of the technology, and I did also definitely buy into that sort of requirement for standards to be set in the right way. And so that's a long-winded answer to your question, the original trigger back in the day, back in 2014. Mm. So yeah, it was a good journey.
So Joey, you have worked on so many different legal projects, right? So you have got to know Jonathan and Libra Diem days. You mentioned Gibraltar. You mentioned like the work around the United Nations. Like, was there, you know, let's say kind of a key or single experience that mostly shaped kind of how you thought about digital money? Or was this, you know, some kind of an evolution of your perspectives over the years since you went into the space?
I think that's a good question. I mean, you mentioned and we've talked about to Libra a couple of times. I mean, I think what's been really, really clear, that there are a couple of sort of factors to this. One is plugging new technology into legacy systems doesn't work. So in the kind of classic securities example in the US, etc., you know, trying to create sort of frameworks for completely new assets, completely new forms of risk, completely new forms of technology, and saying, you know, we have a legacy infrastructure, we have a legacy framework, we have legacy rules, let's apply them, is not the right approach. So I think, you know, the principles can remain the same, the concept of risk can remain the same, but the way that those need to be approached needs to be changed. What I've definitely learned is that that's a long, slow sort of learning process for authorities and policymakers, and it's quite difficult. Also, like the speed of innovation at a tech level versus the speed of development at a legal reg level is not the same. Obviously, there's very, very significant inconsistencies, and that needs ongoing sort of coaching and development and buy-in and understanding. So if you had a conversation with whatever, a bank X years ago, and you talked about compliance in a virtual asset context, the starting point is, okay, this is all really, really bad, and this is very, very difficult, and it's all very, very dodgy. Then when you start showing them analytics and systems and transaction monitoring capability, and you understand the concept of an immutable ledger of data, and you show risk metrics around how you can do that, it doesn't like flick a switch from off to on, but it's sort of, okay, that's interesting. And you start to use those analogies. You know, if I turned up with a $50, $100 note, and I'm going to show you a risk analysis of how that dollar note was used since it was printed, I'm going to show you the equivalent of that in a virtual asset context. It changes, but everyone that wants to change anything in this ecosystem is not going to do it with a hit of a button. It needs like persistence and consistency and, you know, non-stop kind of development. And then, you know, like you need to be ready to sort of move with the changes. So, you know, that the Libra example we talked about, it's super interesting, but the trigger that was for so many developments around the globe is very significant, very, very significant. And we can talk about some of the pluses and minuses or lessons learned or positives and negatives, but, you know, same thing. There has to be absolute consistency with the end objective and real commitment to that if you really want to have any kind of success. I think that's a general message, yeah.
Yeah, and talking like, you know, a little bit more on Libra, as you said, like, obviously, we know Libra didn't launch, but would you say in a today's world with Mika, Genius, also OpenUSD now coming up, right, and other major payment companies going into space, do you think like the project would have seen light of day?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, I mean, Libra identified the real kind of payments infrastructure gap and, you know, got sort of 20 or so blue chip companies together to sort of co-invest in solving that problem. And, you know, now you're kind of, you know, forward, hit the forward button, and that sort of coalition logic is really what OpenUSD is kind of replicating with 140 companies. You know, what went wrong? That's a difficult and complex one, but, you know, the original concept of trying to mint almost like a new currency unit, so the sort of basket-backed synthetic rather than the dollar, you know, and it was very much led or seen to be led by one company as a controller, and that was Facebook in that context. You know, you had the sort of sovereignty threat plus concentration risk in one package. And that is extremely difficult to get over the line. But, you know, you're not talking about it. There's no sort of fatal flaw in the technology, and there's no fatal flaw in the consortium model. And that, again, interesting example of OpenUSD and that sort of model that they're following now. But there was such a global regulatory backlash to that, and there was so much push for developing the framework. And we did at the time, and I think I actually ran the Mika presentation as to what exactly was being targeted and why it was being targeted. You know, the Genius development, and that being the sort of front runner for developments in the US, and one of the reasons that got on the over the line in the speed that it did as a sort of front runner was exactly because of this as well. The issue is there, the problem is happening, the growth is very real. And this is not like specific to stablecoins or anything else. What tends to happen is sort of there's an initial pushback, then there's sort of innovative growth with the good stuff and the bad stuff all packaged together. You have the blow-ups, you have the problem scenarios, you have et cetera, et cetera. You know, even when we talk about the wider crypto space, you have the FATF, who effectively built an AML framework. That is the body of the FATF and their kind of mandate. And that has, you know, quite quickly evolved into, wait a second, you know, let's put it, simple analogy, no matter the AML framework or compliance universe that you've built around, you know, FTX, if you have like core governance gaps and core sort of infrastructure gaps, and you're not really embedding the requirement to, you know, safely custody customer assets off balance sheet, then you're going to have problems. So now you're sort of moving into the prudential world of MiCA and the Clarity Act and the UK frameworks, et cetera, et cetera. So it almost sort of slowly develops to get to the point of understanding what is actually required. And so Libra was one of the triggers. Maybe there was a lot of pushback then, but now look at the Tether numbers, look at the fact that, you know, I mean, Tether were fined $30 million or whatever it was by the CFTC at one point for not having the assets in custody to back the USDT in issuance. That was totally unregulated. But now, then you have the front runners, you have the circles, you have the developments, you have the application, you have the rules, and that starts to happen, and that's what sort of slowly opens the door. At the beginning, the pushback is this really that relevant? Then the numbers start to happen. Then the transaction flow is real. Then the data is very, very real. And then the policymakers go, okay, wait a second. Now we really need to control this. And that becomes a good facilitator. The difficult, and this is the kind of policy interjection, that the difficult bit is when too many problems start to happen, that the rules that start to get developed are almost like restrictive. Whilst if the engagement is early enough, it's much more innovative. It's much more, let's facilitate the growth of this industry. So we always, and I won't be the only one that says this, but finding the right balance between supporting innovation, you know, on the left, and consumer protection as an extreme on the right, you know, how do you find the right interjection and balance of a system that allows innovation to happen and creates a secure environment for the people on the right? And if you go too far over the line and too much bad stuff happens, the weighting goes way, way too far to the right. And if that doesn't happen, it can go too far to the left, and that can also create problems. So it's this forever problem of finding that sort of balance. And sometimes you need the big pushes to to make those discussions happen. And I think Libra was definitely a part of that in the stablecoin context. Yeah.
I totally agree from my perspective. And I love the way you frame that. And it was ironic how, you know, on the one hand with FINMA, with, you know, the regulatory college and all the regulators were brought along on the 2-year process. On the other hand, so much scrutiny while at the same time, zero scrutiny for other providers. At that point, we're still reaching kind of a critical mass. But so with that as sort of the background, do you anticipate the OpenUSD to get a lot of regulatory pushback now? Or do you think we've overcome some of the initial questions, and there'll certainly be inquiries, but, you know, it won't be a pushback like we experienced at Libra. But what do you expect on the OpenUSD front?
I mean, that's a really good question as well. I think that there are two things to answer. The first one is, on that first point, you're absolutely right. In this world, in the crypto universe, you have sort of different camps. You have the sort of ultra conservative and the ultra risky. The ultra conservative, I'll put Libra in that camp, doesn't want to do anything until the rules are there, the applications are made, the approvals are in place. Let's be very, very safe and conservative. And then in the blue corner and in the red corner, let's just do it. And let's go and let's see what happens. And then let's deal with problems as and when they occur. I've worked for many or most of the biggest platforms in the world in this space, and I can tell you that there are sometimes legal assessments, and they, it's almost like a cost analysis. So if we introduce these rules, what's the attrition rate of our customer base going to be? Oh, it's going to be like 40%. Yeah, okay. And if we don't introduce the rules and we're fined and subject to enforcement action in 14 countries over 3 years, what's the cost going to be? And they go, $18.2 million. We go, well, okay, so 40% attrition is going to cost $500 million. So doesn't matter. Just go ahead, press the go button. Sometimes does create these problems. And it's kind of frustrating when you're too far in the conservative camp of wanting to do things properly and seeing everyone else sort of race into the future. But again, there's balances there. You know, we've also seen examples, if you go too far over the line, then you can't get back in the camp. And that also happens. Once you step too far over a regulator's mandate and control, and then you come back to them to apologize, it's too late. And that's also another risk management sort of assessment that these groups sometimes need to conduct. I think that to answer your question more specifically, OpenUSD is in a totally different scenario to Libra. There are lots of interesting things that happen. Firstly, what's going to make this possibly a really good success? It's not so much like zero fees, and those kinds of things are pretty easy to match. What's powerful is 140 companies with existing, consumer distributions simultaneously aligned to promote the same asset, because they now share in the float income instead of it just being, plumbing it through to one single entity. So there's a massive conglomerate of interest in that. So the reserve income sharing is a real kind of structural innovation, and it really kind of flips who captures the stablecoin economics. So if you use the Circle Tether, effectively keeping that reserve yield, the OpenUSD proposes to share it, that sort of net of a management fee, which the partners, doing the distribution, maintain, etc. But that's really, really interesting. I think that there are people don't talk about the wrinkles, maybe, but I know, and I'm not a US like super expert, although I do have lots of engagement with the authorities there. I think the Genius Act, the sort of the yield payment ban to interest rooted through issuers' affiliates, which that could cut through the OpenUSD reserve sharing model. I'm not sure. I think there's going to be a carve out for profit sharing with independent partners, which is what OpenUSD is trying to be. But I think the final rules haven't been codified yet. So let's see what happens. And then outside of the Genius Act, you have the Clarity Act and the market structure provisions. And that's where the real fight over whether the model is going to be durable or not is going to happen. I think it's going to be more at that clarity level than the Genius level, the kind of revenue sharing split. I mean, that could come into difficult pressures, but you know, nothing's finalized yet, so let's see. So in answer to your question in one line, Jonathan, I think it's a great initiative. I think the timing is great. It's a completely different regulatory environment. You know, the clarity in the US is directly from the president's office at the top, and that's flowing through down every organization and body in the US. So to, you know, facilitate this kind of development, I think the model's really interesting, but I do think that there are going to be some pressure points.
I think the model is really interesting from an incentive alignment perspective. Time will tell whether, you know, the 140, you know, how many of the 140 are logo partners or roll up your sleeves and get to work partners. As we know, this is hard. Governance is hard. Democracy is hard, as we used to joke, right? So we will see. But
I mean, the yielding point and the stablecoin yield sort of argument, the income point, etc., that's always interesting. And you know, lots of interesting discussions in the US around that as well. You know, Xapo, from our perspective, we've approached this in a really, really different and innovative way, always looking to comply. But if you think about the conversation in the US at the moment, you have sort of, you know, in the red corner, the banking universe, and in the blue corner, the crypto space. And everyone's kind of fighting. You know, the banks are concerned about a flight of capital into sort of regulated crypto platforms that are effectively paying deposit yields. And in the blue camp, the crypto industry is saying that this has to be facilitated for accessibility and speed and efficiency and all of the good stuff. And then sort of in the middle of that boxing ring, you have Xapo, who, you know, has a banking license on the left, but is also ultra blockchain and Bitcoin native on the right. So the way that we've approached this is to maintain a banking charter, but, you know, we are, and I will say this, a Bitcoin native business that's obtained a banking license. We're not a bank exploring blockchain technology because it sounds interesting. That means that we can address things slightly differently. So we don't pay yields on stable coins, but what we've done is introduce a stable coin as a payment rail to your bank account. So, you know, you send 100 USDC or 100 USDT, but you receive 100 USD, which is a bank account. So your savings deposit there is paid a yield, and that yield we actually pay in BTC and Satoshis. So that it doesn't get more sort of crypto native than that. We facilitate the transaction, stablecoin to USD onto your bank account. Yield is from, you know, US treasuries and HQLA deployments, very boring and safe. And then that yield is converted and paid to you in BTC. So that's kind of fully, fully compliant. We are fully, fully licensed on absolutely every front. And that's how you kind of approach this sort of never-ending point that I hear around convergence and symbiosis and crossover between financial services and crypto. Everyone talks about that, but no one's actually doing it. And that's what we've built and done. And that has not been an easy journey. So, yeah.
That's super. And I think let's jump, you know, you've already started talking about Xapo, and I wanted to get into that because what you are doing is very, very unique in my view. And you started to touch on it, but so how would you specifically describe the problem you guys are solving at Xapo that on the one hand, traditional banks weren't or are not, as well as what the crypto side was also struggling to solve for?
Yeah, I think it's that question of convergence. So we're BTC native. We don't touch lots of virtual assets. We don't really believe in that. We've had the same mission from, you know, 2013. Yeah, the objective is providing a platform that allows people to protect, secure, and grow their wealth. And we've always said since 2013 that BTC should form part of that. It was great in December last year when BlackRock and Morgan Stanley and all of these guys started talking about sort of a 2-4% allocation to Bitcoin forming part of a model portfolio. And they saw that as reasonable. That's great when Morgan Stanley and JPM say that kind of stuff. We've been saying that since 2014, but to do it in a secure, controlled sort of regulated environment, and not create this sort of battleground between this is the crypto world and this is the financial services world. I said it before, how do you create a convergence of those systems by applying the same standards across and align that sort of spectrum or interaction, or you know, full sort of convergence to actually happen? So I'm trading on platform XYZ, I have an interest in DeFi exploration and whatever yielding products that are out there, that's very interesting, but I also, you know, might want to come out of that space into secure environment because I need a mortgage, or I want to buy a house, and you know, want to buy some coffee at Marks and Spencer's or whatever it is. So how do you converge those systems to say, yes, I want that universe to develop and explore, but I don't want to create a new universe. I want it to interact with the existing systems and standards that we've built and developed, and that's really what we've done. So even though we've been around in since, you know, 2013, we don't touch any other virtual assets. We don't, that's a whole other discussion. We wanted to facilitate that sort of, that bridge, that banking bridge, and that full convergence and interface between the two spaces together within one platform. So okay, yeah, so that's really stablecoins as well, you know, yeah.
Yeah, the bridge between both digital assets, digital money, crypto on the one hand side, and let's say traditional banking on the other hand side.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
I mean, Joey, I think what's also super unique about, you know, the work and the project you worked on is that this is really kind of global. So you're always telling stories where you, you know, travel to, and I probably you're jet lagged probably most of the week because you're traveling so much. So I think it's also good because you have like a great overview on our great perspectives on how the regulatory regimes compare. So let's maybe double down a little bit on that in the remaining time. So you already started a little bit on the US topic with the stablecoin yields, right? What's kind of your, let's say, overall assessment currently on the US framework? So maybe both Genius and Clarity, where we do see, of course, a lot of progress, but it's not final yet, and that not everything is final yet, right? So what's your perspective, you know, with the insights you have on the regulatory regime that is in the US here, or also like still upcoming part?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, we won't have time to go into sort of forensic breakdowns or anything like that, but I think the good thing about, if I can use another kind of quasi analogy, if you have a discussion with the US sort of authorities, et cetera, it's a, if I can call it in inverted commas, a much more kind of open door policy. So they want to create a framework that allows this industry to find a home and to flourish and develop. Absolutely, they want it to be regulated to the right standard, but it's slightly different series of questions. It's almost more along the lines of, you know, do you have the people? Do you have the finance? Do you have the systems? Do you have the understanding? That's great. And, you know, we want that to happen. We want there to be the next 5 or 10 unicorns to be domiciled in the US. But if another 150 fail, that's okay, because they're operating to the right standard. In other parts of the world, it's not like that. So I'd say, broadly speaking, the EU, absolutely, definitely speaking, the UK, it's almost like they only want to regulate the business when there's a 0% chance of failure. So like 0%. And that becomes much, much more conservative in the rules that are determined, in the infrastructure that's required, and in the modeling that these businesses need to go through. That it's not there to sort of create a hotbed for innovation and development. It's almost like setting a series of rules to not really allow that to happen. In Asia, it's also much more sort of supportive, much more supportive. I can't go jurisdiction by jurisdiction. It sort of changes slightly here and there, but the focus points are completely different. So whilst in the US, yeah, there are a lot of discussions around the yield. There are a lot of, you know, developer protection focuses around the DeFi questions, etc. Quite technical. If you have those discussions in some other parts of the world, they're almost irrelevant. They're not really focused in any way in that kind of question. The focus is much more around custody as a concept and security. As soon as you go into DeFi it's almost like, look, guys, let's look at that. Yeah, we'll think about that later. At the moment, let's focus on the FATF recommendations. Let's look at the 4 or 5 definitions of a virtual asset service provider and capture that. So the US is much more developed in that context. It's much more open to wanting to create that hotbed. And, you know, even like we've talked a lot about stablecoins, so I'll just use that as an example. You know, why does that happen? That President Trump wants the digital dollar to become the currency of the Web3, the internet, and the digital universe. So the Genius Act happens. And suddenly, you have absolute and total dominance of that market from a US perspective. What happens in the UK? The Bank of England produces a series of rules that the reserve assets backing a stablecoin and issuance in GBP basically are non-interest bearing. Then they change the rules to 40% of the assets are going to be non-interest bearing on a reserve account at the Bank of England. It almost destroys the model. And then after like masses and masses and masses of discussion and debates, they move that from 40% to 30%. And that's seen as a massive victory. But it's not even a requirement in the US, and it's not even a requirement in the EU. And there, the discussions are around restricting access of digital pounds to unhosted wallets completely. Or cap limits, originally, it was £20,000 for an individual and £10 million for a corporate. And now that's been removed, and they've come up with a sort of $40 billion total market cap of the platform. Again, all of these are all very small points, but it's restrict and control, restrict and control, restrict and control. And the US, it's develop and innovate, develop and innovate, develop and innovate. And that kind of flows through not just from the sort of people that are writing the rules, but the people that are monitoring and implementing the rules. And that's the really critical factor. So it doesn't really matter what the rules say. You know, if you don't have an authority that can not just authorize, but you know, supervise and have the understanding to actually, you know, monitor and supervise the activity, that creates another big problem. And that's also, I think, you know, where you meet some of the teams at the SEC, et cetera, they're really, really smart guys. And they really kind of understand a lot of the key sort of really complex topics. And in other parts of the world, that isn't really yet happening. So I'd say that on the front end, the US is in a very strong position. And in the back office, I think that they're probably in an even stronger position. And that's without going into some of the more technical stuff like, you know, CARF, the crypto asset reporting framework, which is the kind of crypto equivalent of CRS or FATCA. You know, the OECD has been pushing that for years. That's already taken effect under DAC 8 in the EU. It's taken effect in the UK. It's all public information as to what country is introducing CARF when. The US has, for now, penciled 2029. But, you know, they may not even transpose that. And again, that's another big differentiator for platforms that are considering domiciles and markets. You know, if you have global transaction monitoring obligations into every country in the world today, if you're domiciled in Berlin or Paris or London, but you have none if you're domiciled in New York or Washington, that's not immaterial. So, you know, these are other kind of, you know, smaller points that are also relevant, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the zooming out is super, super helpful, Joey, to see that regulators kind of tackle this, like, problem, let's say, from different angles, and then you know, have different approaches, like maybe, you know, without also going too deep, you know, for time constraints. But we know that now there is also the MiCA 2.0 consultation, right? So the commission asking what should change around MiCA, what does not work, how can we do things better, maybe like focusing on, you know, one or two core pieces of that. What would you basically say that should be, you know, should be changed so that Europe can, let's say, flourish a little bit more on the digital money, digital currency side of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, I mean, it's kind of mid-review. MiCA 2.0, I think the consultations, like, it was, I think there were like 80 or so questions, and they're open for feedback to the end of August. The no interest rule on stable coins is one there. The sort of equivalence regime for global third country stable coins, whether that something like that is relevant. The way that the EU is built at the moment, not just under MiCA, but with the ESMA guidelines, etc. It's almost like creating, and you're seeing this emerge more and more as rules and law and frameworks develop. This is an online digital space that operates on a cross-border sort of international perspective. And, you know, in the olden days, you'd have the DeFi guy say, yeah, we don't have a domicile, therefore we're not subject to rules anywhere. That's not right. You're actually subject to rules everywhere. You can be caught within absolutely any one of those frameworks. But the EU sort of almost trying to close the loop and say, you know, to operate within this territory, you need to be regulated within that territory. In the UK, similar. You had originally the financial promotion rules, where if you're, you know, offering anything that constitutes any form of inducement to anyone in the UK, you're obliged to comply. And with the new framework, you're going to be caught within the requirements to be regulated in the UK. And it's not just jurisdictional. You have Google and the Play Store, and they've developed, this is all public information as well, so requirements for crypto platforms to offer their applications in, I think, 15 countries for now, to be registered in those countries. You know, Apple had a similar approach, but maybe they updated their terms a year and a half or ago or so as well. So you're creating these sort of, to onboard someone from a country or to operate in a country, you need to. So now you're seeing the focus point starting to be on that sort of cross-border acknowledgement, equivalent standards, what can be recognized and not recognized. I think that's a really, really interesting point for the industry. It's going to become more and more critical, but extremely difficult. And then also you have things in the EU, like the asset reference token, the art sort of stuff. It's been almost 2 years, and I think none of them have been licensed.
Still zero.
So far.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still zero, exactly. So,
exactly.
You know, that's an interesting point to see whether, you know, going on from us, whether the stablecoin regime in practice is more restrictive than it is on paper, sort of how much is it actually going to facilitate? And then the biggest sort of gap piece in all of it, it will be decentralized finance or DeFi. And I think that's going to be really interesting. So you had the rules that were determined. You had the FATF, you had MiCA, then you had the FATF to update that to this kind of concept of control and influence over a contract. And then you had legislators sort of trying to understand that. And, you know, you have lots of sort of developments as to what that test could be. And, you know, you have people again in the EU saying, well, but DeFi is completely out of scope and it isn't caught. I don't think that's right, by the way. I think the definitions that were introduced to MiCA were almost like specifically written to define Bitcoin as a decentralized operation that's outside of the scope of regulation. But anything that comes in between us starts to feel like the arrangement of a transaction, you know, could be caught. And it's learning and development, and the authorities are not in a massive sort of race to do that. But the question is going to be, does it become even clearer that all of this activity is brought within prudential scope? Or is it going to be, you know, defined clearly enough to allow an out-of-scope operation? Let's see. But I definitely think that that's going to be a big pressure point that the DeFi space will be at.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it's been talked about since the beginning of MiCA. And yeah, there's two views. It's out of scope or it's in scope. But I think that's going to be a big piece to work through here next. So because of time, we're going to close out with a new section, Joey, called the lightning round. Jonas, we need theme music, I think, for this. We have no theme music. But so the idea is, and we just started this a couple episodes ago, was to ask you a few questions, just some initial reactions to it. You don't have to go deep on any one of these things, but just sort of your kind of initial reaction to it. The first one, self-custodial wallets, which I know is near and dear to your heart, is that a regulatory headache or an essential feature?
I think it's an essential feature. And I think it's, am I allowed to answer this properly or do I have like 5 seconds or something?
No, you can do it properly, okay.
Well, 10 seconds.
in a minute.
Okay. I think it's a requirement, but I think the key is going to be around how authorities allow interaction or engagement with the unhosted space. That's going to be the real key. So let's call it the edge enforcement space around the rules that allow or don't allow you to interact with that system. I'm completely against what I call a kind of two-tiered system of saying, well, you're either in the regulator space or you're in the unregulated space, and let's push everything into one segment or the other. I think they have to be able to interact, and the rules around how that's done or the assessments around how that's done need to be understood and developed and approved. Not absolutely not bringing that within a regulatory perimeter, but allowing the interaction to happen in a way that satisfies their concerns around risk. So it has to be protected, absolutely.
Okay, cool, cool. All right, next one, and super brief on this one. Just we're talking, you know, the big rage is now stablecoins. Obviously, if you're talking about tokenized deposits, there's CBDCs, there's CBMTs, there's a myriad of things. Fast forward 5 years from now, what do you think will have mattered more?
Oh my God.
tough questions, huh?
What would have happened the most? I think no major failures, the big swingers in the space, and absolute and clear regulatory certainty. If you have both of those two aligned, that's a big success story. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Just again, lightning round answer. Perfect. And we covered a little bit on it, but just top of mind, what do you think the biggest misconception about Libra has been?
When people come and talk to you? That it failed on technology or ambition. I think it failed on, you know, the story, the governance concentration, and the sort of currency sovereignty framing. That initial trigger created too much of a headwind.
Yeah, I think very similar, Jonathan, to what Christian Catalini also shared with us, right, when he was part of the show a couple of weeks ago.
Exactly. Yeah, super. Hey, we're running short on time, so let me just say from my side, thank you so much, Joey. Really appreciate you sharing all your experience and your insights.
Good stuff. No, thank you, guys. Been good to chat and stuff, and I hope that was interesting, and yeah. Thanks very much.
Yes, it really was, Joey. So we'll definitely link more about, you know, your person, your work, also Xapo Bank in the show notes. So if people are interested in checking out, then they can do so. And also, obviously, for everyone listening, thanks for joining Bitcoin, Fiat, Rock and Roll. Hope you really liked the episode. If you do, please, you know, recommend us to your friends, family, or everybody who thinks is or should be interested in the future of money. You also can give us 5-star review, etc., comment, follow our Telegram group. So a lot of ways of interacting. Thanks for listening to this episode, and stay tuned for next episode next week. Thank you very much.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.